Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
To me, it's about really forming an emotional connection with people. And that's my dream. All I've ever wanted is to be in a band. And it's mostly musical because I enjoy writing songs and playing music. But really what I want is to not be alone and not be lonely. And I want a little tribe of people around me that I want to fight the ills of the world off with.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory, but we drew the map.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together. Let's welcome our guest today, Curious Creatures, Josh Klinghoffer.
Thank you.
So where are you, Josh, at the moment? In LA?
Yeah, I'm in Pasadena.
Oh, in Pasadena. Okay.
Because you're in, where are you?
I'm on the west side. I'm down by Venice and stuff.
And Budgie, you're?
I'm in Berlin.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm down the southwest side.
Right. I'll be there in a couple weeks, actually.
You coming through here?
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly which date, but I think it's the second show on the tour I'm about to embark on.
You're touring with?
With Pearl Jam.
With Pearl Jam.
Yeah. I mean, I think I saw you at the Ohana Festival.
Last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
I played the two successive Ohana Festivals, and it was very strange. It was deja vu because I had played with the Chili Peppers in 2019, and then the world shut down for a bit, and then the next time there was an Ohana Festival, I played with a different band, but also in the headlining slot with different people around. It's very strange.
You also hold some kind of, it's the accolade for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you're inducted as, I think, the youngest inductee.
I was just informed a week ago that slightly dubious honor has been stolen from me. Not stolen, but I've been usurped by the guy who has played drums for Nine Inch Nails for a long time. And he started with them, Elon, he's called, and he started with them when he was quite young. And he's now, after playing with them for 10 years, he's in the Hall of Fame. And so he was 31 at the time, where I was 32. And it was kind of a farcical that I was in it at all, because I just happened to be a current member of the Chili Peppers. I wasn't on the journey with them while they were, you know, having this whatever Hall of Fame career is. I guess it, for something so sort of funny, the fact that I had usurped Stevie Wonder was kind of this, it was a talking point, if nothing else. And now I got nothing except, I guess, membership to the Hall of Fame that I don't feel I deserve.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I feel in a small way, maybe I had a little hand in that, because when The Cure were inducted a couple of years ago, 2019, we were asked, well, who would we like to, you know, induct us? Who would we like to do the speech? And I suggested Trent, and I think several other people did. So we got Trent Reznor to come and, you know, give us our awards. And then I think they got in next year, and I'm pretty certain, because you'll know this, you get a little ballot through and you get the chance to vote, and I'm sure that I voted for Trent, of course. And so, you know, by me putting him in and his band, you know, I've taken the... I apologize.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. Well, but if you watch the Chili Peppers when they were inducted, which I believe was 2012, so that's why, I mean, I spent 10 years in the band. So at this point, you know, I feel like I was a proper member. But at the time, I was fairly new. And The Cure, who have always been one of my favorite bands, were up on the ballot as well. And you right. got, and so if you watch my performance, I'm wearing a Cure shirt.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in a sort of protest. So I wore it under my, it's perfectly visual. I actually borrowed it because it was a Head on the Door shirt, and I didn't have one, and I always coveted my friends, and I was planning on wearing it at the Hall of Fame and then not giving it back, but he asked for it back.
Well, that's very noble of you.
That's a funny thing, though. I'm going to sort of come in with, you were saying you played in the Chili Peppers for 10 years, and so you felt like you were a proper member rather than the new boy. How long? Because I think that's one thing you and I share in common, is we've played in many bands. I've not played in that many. You've played in bands of a very high stature. You joined the Chili Peppers, well-established, I think, right? But so how long were you the new boy, and what's it like being the new boy?
Well, I think in a sense I was always that, you know, the entire time.
Yeah,
I mean, certainly was. I mean, whether I could have been in the band for 30 years and I'd still be 18 years younger than those guys. So, you know, right. they were perfectly, right. you know, welcoming and gracious. I never felt like a second class citizen or anything. I just, you know, you can't help but feel that you are arriving a bit late to the party.
It's funny because you say that Jason Cooper, who's a lovely man, plays drums for The Cure. Now, he's played drums for them for longer than I did, but people still think of him as the new boy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you think, what's it been like, Joshua? I mean, you know, jumping in, first of all, on the tailcoat of John Frusciante, you know, who I believe is a very dear friend.
He was. He and I haven't really had a friendship in 10 years or more, actually, more like 12. Once I joined the band, we sort of parted ways, you know, not in a truly acrimonious way, but more just because I think it was hard to maintain the friendship when he was sort of trying to distance himself from the band and I was trying to distance myself from his legacy in the band at the time, so I could try and establish my own. But it's funny, I actually listened to some of his solo music that I played drums on an hour, you know, in the last hour. I listened to a couple of songs because I started as a drummer, which you may have been told, or I'm not sure. That was my first instrument. So I was trying to make a connection with some of the recorded proof of that. And I hadn't really allowed myself to listen to some of those records that I did with John for, you know, almost a decade, just because it was kind of sad for me. Because as I say, we didn't really have a relationship anymore. But I mean, it was the craziest thing I could ever have been asked to do, to fill that spot in a band like that, especially at that time. I wasn't really focusing on the guitar at all. I was playing lots of piano and lots of learning the modular synthesizer and kind of doing that sort of thing. And when he left the band and it was, you know, proposed to me to do that, I my first thought was, oh, there's no way I can do this. it was an emotional ride the whole time, because when I first began, obviously, born of the ashes of our friendship, at the time, it took me a while to feel comfortable in that position. And I sort of geared my creative impulses, I almost put myself under these rules about what kind of chord progressions I could write. And I was just desperately trying to establish my own sound at least as a writer in that band, the first time around. I kind of promised myself I wouldn't write anything that even remotely sounded like something he would write. And I think I probably went above and, you know, too far with that, because at the end of the day, it is still them, and that is still kind of what people want. But I think I was just trying desperately to create my own space.
I can empathize, though, with this, because, you know, Susie and the Banshees had many guitarists.
All called John, by the way. Right.
And they had a similar thing, because, of course, there was only, when I joined, there were two albums. And I just had like two albums worth of drumming to kind of take on board and try and impose your own character in there without taking too much away, but trying to add something. And then that seemed to be, after the third album, I was kind of established. But the Johns, the guitarists, were always had the weight of and like four, five, six. How many albums did you have to take on board?
I think I came aboard on, they had done about, I want to, nine maybe.
Oh, good Lord.
And I, they didn't play loads from the first three, I'd say, as much as I always kind of wish they did. That was just sort of off limits to a degree, those records, which I think is kind of an important place to start from when you're playing in that band, or for those guys playing music. And I heard that when John first returned to the band this time around, they spent at least a week or two just playing those old first three albums that John's not even a part of. They were the first things that he played, obviously, when he took over for the original guitar player, Hillel Slovak. And yeah, I just kind of regretted not spending time with them doing that. When I joined with them, we jumped right into songwriting. We barely had established a connection musically at all. It was just sort of, all right, let's go.
Right.
Which was amazing in its own way, that you could just sort of hit the ground running. And then for whatever reason, they trusted me enough to kind of start that way. But, you know, now in hindsight, I lament really kind of just not really diving into the core of what made that group that group.
Who was your guiding hand into the Chili Peppers? You walked into the room. There was like, you know, three statuesque, iconic figures there in the room. You know.
Let's see. Well, the funny thing was that I was sort of a little pissant in their wake. You know, for the last decade prior to when I started playing, I was just this little guy on the always around. Mm-hmm. When I first showed up, it was almost like. I mean, it was, I always thought it's such a strange situation. It's a strange situation in general to replace someone like John for a period and just sort of start anew with someone at that point in their career. But on the flip side, I was so well versed in the machine that was the Chili Peppers. I knew how everything went. I knew where the tea kettle was in the dressing room. I knew where the socks were. You know, I had toured with them as well as a second guitar player at a certain period in sort of 07 when they were finishing that particular tour cycle, and they made a double album and they couldn't really play some of the songs on it because there were lots of guitar overdubs that John couldn't do all of. So I sort of jumped up board the last 6 months or so of that tour. And I was kind of deep in their world for a while.
It sounds like a little like when Bernard Butler left Suede and the guy who took over.
Richard Oakes?
Yeah, like almost identikit.
Yeah.
I was really into that record that Suede put out in sort of 96. And I remember seeing him at the time, and I knew the story. I mean, and it reminded me kind of John joining the Chili Peppers after Hillel, and then it reminded me of me joining the Chili Peppers after John. I mean, you could tell the guy was enormously influenced by Bernard Butler, and he knew the Suede songs really well, and it sounded great when they played songs from the previous two albums, and I really liked that Coming Up record. I mean, it just came out at a particular time when I was all about bands like that, and I loved it. I saw them here at El Rey
Yeah, it's a strange thing when, I don't know, when people, they form something, it's on the cusp, it's about to go really huge, and then they kind of, they pull apart. A strange thing, must have been strange for Bernard Butler to hear the band just continue and onto greater things. And you go, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kurt said, like, shouldn't have been so damn influential. Shouldn't have been so great and inspiring.
Have you lived anywhere outside of LA?
No, it's a funny story. I have these, I don't know if you could see, I've got the squirrels. They're dying for some food outside. You see?
Oh, I love squirrels.
I haven't lived anywhere else. And I guess the only reason I've allowed myself to keep that as my life is that I've done a fair amount of touring. So
right.
I was so close to leaving LA because I grew up hating it here. I didn't like the sun. I didn't like the people. I felt were just, I don't know. I was just a pretentious young child, I guess, who was always dreaming of it being better and more. There was higher intelligence and better dressed people on the East Coast or in Europe even more. So my whole family's from the East Coast. So we went back there quite a bit, and I just always was mad at my parents for moving to California. So I was over it. I was done. I was going to leave. And I remember that I was on the phone with companies rental companies, and trying to find some company that would allow me to do a one-way rental. So can I return on the East Coast? And I was having a really hard time doing that, finding that. And the way I remember it is on my mobile phone, where I was on a landline, mobile phone rang, and it was my still dear friend, Steve McDonald from the band Red Cross.
Right.
And he was calling to invite me or to ask if I would go on tour with him in the band Sparks.
Right.
And yes. So I was sort of like van company and tour with Sparks, and I hung up, you know, on this hand, I was about to leave LA and just move to my aunt and uncle's guest house to sort of figure out from where to go from there. And then on the other hand, I thought, oh, a 3-week tour with Sparks, sort of playing rhythm guitar, not too much responsibility, just like really, I know a lot of these songs anyway. Oh, great, tour with Steve again, because he and I played in Beck. Oh, this is nothing but fun. We're going to go to, it's the winter, it was February, and we're going to go to Russia and Sweden and all these cold places. I loved it. And from that decision with two phones in each hand, one thing literally kind of led to the next to where I am today. Because it was that Sparks tour and getting involved in that, which then put me backstage at a Gnarls Barkley gig, because we were on a one-night layover on our way to Russia again, where I agreed to play keyboards with Gnarls Barkley backstage, drunk at that show. I woke up the next morning going, what? What did I say I would do? Yeah. Shit. So that was that. That led to keyboards with Gnarls Barkley for a while, and then that band opened for the Chili Peppers, which then led to me, who I already knew and was friendly with, that led to me taking a trip with them to Mexico at the end of their tour to play one more gig down there, or on the way home, from which I was invited to go on the rest of their tour. And after that, you know, like, so it's like one thing led to another, which put me in the Chili Peppers, which put me where I am here.
You know, it's amazing how all those little connections, and then they join up. I think for all of us as musicians, it's that, it's not like being a sailor. It's sort of a little wanderlust. You know, we've got to go and explore.
I always remember the finish of every tour. I always used to think, wonder what it'd be like to live here. Did you ever, like, end of the tour, just stay on for a few days, weeks? Or were you eager to get back?
I think maybe I was always eager to get back, or had to get back for some other bit of work or something. But yeah, I envision disappearing into these amazing places I find myself all the time.
It's wonderful. So bringing it to nowadays, you have a new project out, right? Plural One?
Yeah. My childhood dream was always to have my own band, you know, and that was one of the reasons I hated, or as a youth, I didn't like LA so much because I found, especially the San Fernando Valley where I was from, I just found like there was no one to play with. There was no one who had an expansive interest in music outside, you know, what the radio was playing, and no one was really that interesting musically. Luckily, I fell in with some older people and started playing outside of my hometown when I was 17, and my life sort of went on from there. But my dream was always to have a band, and I like collaborating with people. But at the time, I was a drummer when I was first, you know, forming these dreams. So as I became more of a guitarist or a songwriter, which took me a long time to actually have enough time to really work on. Yeah, I never really had the chance to see that dream through because I was playing with all the people I mentioned earlier in my 20s. And finally, at a certain point, I started to really feel like, you know, my 20s were almost over, and I had the greatest experiences playing music, but I was not terribly satisfied. And I think that was just because I had never given any real time to my own work. So long story short, hopefully, I was able to form a band with some guys that I met on the Gnarl Sparkly tour and a couple other people. And that turned into a group I had called Dot Hacker. And we were writing songs, getting ready to make a record, and then I joined the Chili Peppers. So that band became kind of a back burner thing, but I was able to keep it together, and we still were able to make 3 albums, but we were never able to be a band because now my time was incredibly booked. I was very spoken for. But after the third Dot Hacker album, it just seemed like no one was really interested in pursuing that any longer, but I never stop writing and I never want to stop making music. So the minute there's a hole in Chili Peppers' schedule, I'm in there recording and making a record. And at some point I just figured, well, I'm just doing this one myself because I'm not going to be the one to call those guys this time. No one seems like I'm always the one picking up the phone. So I'll just do this one myself. And that became the first Plural One album. And I was basically finished with the album when I realized I have to give it a name. And I remembered that name from when I tried to name Dot Hacker that, and they all laughed at me. And I should have taken that as a sign. But I just really didn't have anything else to call it. And in a sort of, you know, kind of like hippie passing the joint around way, I really liked the concept of it. I mean, I felt like everything from the fact that when you look at the one word, you could see a plurality of things in it, including the word alone, and people still say plural alone all the time. Like, I like the idea of, you know, life being some struggle between singularity and plurality, and, you know, and
it's like you, Josh, you are many, many different characters. And in a way, you came out and you exploded in all these different directions until you found this kind of Campbell's condensed version, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, hopefully. You know, I hope so. I mean, I still feel like I'm very much working on where to go musically. I feel like my first 3 albums have been, you know, like a good starting point. That first one, as I said, I was doing still while I was in the Chili Peppers. So it was sort of like, get it done. You know, I started, recorded half of it, and then the Chili Peppers did a bit of work. Then we had some time off, so I finished in the next break. But I was still in the band, so I just assumed that it would slide out and no one would hear
it. It's these damned international superstar bands that keep demanding you. So you could just like tell them to leave me alone already.
lucky enough for me, 3 weeks after I put out that first Plural One album, they fired me. I had 8 days of sort of thinking, oh, well, what do I do now? I mean, I guess it's finally time to step up and not be, you know, hiding behind this other entity that I'm a part of. So yeah, that was the plan. And then I got a call from Eddie from Pearl Jam, and he invited me to go on their next tour, but he was also inviting me to open. So it wasn't the same as usual, where I was just basically spending all my time working for another project. I was able to pursue my own creative outlet and play with them. And they were a very important band to me when I was sort of 11, 12, 13, 14.
Amazing.
Eddie
Vedder calls you up and says, will you open for us? And by the way, will you join the band?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so much join the band. It was, will you join us as an extra helping hand?
Right.
I mean, for all intents and purposes, I'm in their band for this tour and that's for amazing. The foreseeable future. And I mean, that because of the pandemic, we got together in March of 2020, and I had one album to my name, and I was about to open with the most ridiculous, unreliable, harebrained rig you could ever imagine, with tons of looping capabilities, none of which linked up or synced up, and I was about to embarrass myself all over North America, and the that got canceled. So then, you know, during the pandemic, because I had been sort of jumping all over the globe for the last 20 years, sort of, I actually quite enjoyed for once having nothing but free time to work. So I quickly made another album, which came out the following, you know, less than a year after the first one. I made a record with Eddie Vedder last year and Morrissey. I was Morrissey album that's not out yet. All with this producer here in LA called Andrew Watt.
Yeah.
For me, I was able to basically make a record whilst doing all these other things, and Pearl Jam finally went on tour, and that's where we are. And now I'm talking to two of my favorite musicians.
Well, thank you.
And it's June already.
And what a beautiful experience it's been. Oh my goodness. All you got to do now is just hope that the telephone stops ringing long enough for you to...
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Do you ever get a call from somebody and you think, no, it can't be them. Why are they calling me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's happened, yeah.
I got a story about my old partner, Robert, when it was David Bowie's 50th birthday. And Robert's sitting at home one night and he told me this story. He called, the phone rings, and you know, Robert doesn't talk on the phone very much, you know, so he's like, he's surprised that the phone's ringing, picks it up, and it's like, hey, hi Robert, it's David Bowie here. And he thinks, somebody's playing a joke on me, and utters an expletive and throws the phone down. And then about 10 minutes later, the phone rings again and he picks it up and he goes, no, actually, Robert, it really is me. And I want to know if you come and sing on my 50th birthday concert. And he said, I was mortified, you know. It was like, oh, my God.
Let me. It's a wonderful, lots of wonderful stories. And that's what we love trying to dig out. But
yeah.
It's like you've lived a life in reverse, really. You've joined all the major bands desperately trying to get you.
Now you're doing your thing, which is great. You know,
I'm just really trying to get into that little van.
But you mentioned earlier what you said. You said something about the chemistry was right, and I'm just wondering. It's been so easy to talk. I knew it would be easy because somehow this is part of why, I suppose. You could look at your story and go, born with a silver spoon in your mouth and just like happen to be in the right place at the right time always. But what do you put it down to? You know, you were saying chemistry. What goes through your mind as when you join up with these people and...
Well, I've been asked that a couple of times recently, and I sort of it's an amazing question. It's maybe something that I had never really considered, because it keeps happening that I wind up playing with people that are long established and you know that I looked up to and I was influenced by. Right. But I think maybe a perfect combination of shyness. And being young, but also being lucky enough to—I mean, because I would generally consider myself not the most confident person, but in a lot of other ways, I have always had a confidence in my mind.
Right.
I think a combination of being self-assured in the way I think about the world, when dropped into a situation with these older and incredibly creative and inspirational musicians and artists, I am in the perfect place to sort of support them and learn from them. And And I'm honored to be there, period. And, you know, and I think from a, it's sort of, I mean, it's almost, I mean, because I always used to joke about this because I'm sure there's loads of musicians around who look at me and watch me play and go, what the fuck is this guy have? I, you know, fucking, and I think it's
sort everywhere.
Of, it's, yeah, and I'm sure they hate me. And it's music aside. I mean, I think early on, it's about really forming an emotional connection with people. And that's my dream. All I've ever wanted is to be in a band. And it's mostly musical because I enjoy writing songs and playing music. But really what I want is to not be alone and not be lonely. And I want a little tribe of people around me that I want to fight the ills of the world off with. And, you know, and I think when you're younger, you really do have that youthful energy and you do feel like you can make the world a different, better place in some way. And, you know, I think I've been lucky that I still, you know, I mean, look at how I dress. I mean, I'm basically a child. I look the same as I did when I was 20, more or less. And so I think when, you know, when meeting these people or walking to a room with these incredible artists, I do my best, and it's natural. There's nothing forced or insincere. I just really try and be there emotionally, become their friend. And it's happened now in different situations that I finally realized that I used to look at the wall when I was a kid and all the people that I would pin up on my wall. I would say it was rather than saying like, oh, I want to play with them. It was more, I just want to be their friend. I mean, I want.
Oh,
and you know, so
that's beautiful.
I mean, and you know, hopefully we're all friends now. There was one time, I have a funny story. There was one time, I have, through my network of East Side spies and informers, it happened twice, I think. Someone surreptitiously snapped a picture of you two eating at Kitchen Mouse. And, you know, I got these texts with these pictures, like, look what's going on here. And I live 5 minutes from there. So I was about to come over. I didn't, because I thought that'd be too stalkery, but I'm friendly with the people that have that restaurant and who opened it. And so it makes perfect sense that they'd be there. But there was two times where I had to fight the urge to turn up and sit down next to you and go, excuse me. But I would never do that. I don't have the confidence for
but
that.
But you would never do that. You would just.
No,
I'll
wait till I'm on your podcast.
You hit a very good point there about the whole emotional connection, because me and Budgie identify with that completely, because in the end of the day, you know, the business of music can make it seem as though it's like, okay, well, you get this person, you get that person, you put this in, and that makes a band. And we all know that's nonsense. You know, the best bands come from that emotional connection, because without that, how can you do something creative together? You can't be vulnerable enough to let that happen.
I can guarantee that all the people you've worked with, how you explained why you were there and how you were welcomed in, is because that's what they get from you.
I hope so.
Yeah, and it's a subconscious thing as well, you know.
People always ask, who's your favorite drummer? And quite often it was either Ringo Starr or John Bonham. But when I thought about John Bonham, it wasn't like to copy, you know, When the Levee Breaks or Rock. It was, I wanted to meet him and like go, how you doing, John? How's it going?
Yeah.
Like, not in a kind of, I'm with John Bonham. It's more like a kind of, how is it? You know, is it okay? Is things okay?
Did you want to meet Ginger Baker, though?
Well, I thought it, when in his early days, I would have been,
Yeah, his early days, yeah. Later on, maybe not. You know, but
you'd have to duck.
Yeah,
it's kind of like you walk into a room and you, without trying, try. You can see who's okay, who's nervous, who's not sure. And I, like you, feel probably the least secure in many ways. I used to be very shy in school, but here I am, and I still can't envisage myself walking onto a stage. But that's what I did, and that's what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the same thing has been said about me. I was the shyest. You know, I remember having a sort of pep talk with myself at around 17, just thinking, you can't keep going like this. You know, this is not, because just opportunities would arise, or, you know, a moment in a conversation would present itself and I'd have something to interject, or, and I just wouldn't do it. And I just thought, well, you know, I looked into the future and I said, what are you going to be doing this for in your 30s or in your 40s? I mean, because that's not a life to live. So you have to, I mean, it made me sort of just really, I guess, examine whether those things I wanted to say were worthwhile. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I guess it's funny to imagine myself in that place now, because I still feel very much the same person. But I guess it was around that time that I just started thinking, because there were things that would come up musically. And I think you could say the Chili Peppers was even that. Someone asked me to do something and my instinct was, I can't do that. Oh, no way. I mean, I'll be laughed out of the room. I mean, and I would start instantly comparing myself to the person I'm either playing with or playing in the place of or whatever. And then, you know, what kind of life is that? I mean, what are you going to do tomorrow if you don't do it? And I think at some point I had enough courage or drive to just take the chance. And, you know, it on many occasions, it worked out pretty well. And I think, no, because, no, like I said, it's not music, really. It's no matter what you can accomplish musically or technically, it's who you are and what you, yeah. how you elevate a situation or bring, or what you do to a room or a band.
And it's also that you have to love yourself before you can give love to the world or any kind of connection with that. You know, if you don't love yourself, if you don't think, oh, I could probably do that. And I mean, by love, I don't mean in an egotistical way. I mean, in a giving way. And without doing that, not much else is going to happen, because people can't read your mind. You know, I used to sit there and think, why can't people understand what I'm thinking? Well, of course they can't.
No, I mean, that's like a topic that I still am going over 3 times a week with a paid professional. You know, it blows my mind that people can't, if they know me at all, like, how do you not know what I expect and what I want, what I desire at all times.
Josh, is there still a little bit of the, you know, that little voice in the head that goes like, I what, me?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also one of the most difficult things about it because I'm, you know, I'm 20 plus, almost 30 years into this journey, is that at times, I mean, it's like, Lowell, what you just said, I mean, about self-love and about respecting yourself enough. I mean, because what I said before that about, I always had enough of a belief in myself and just the way I looked at the world, even though I felt like a gross, ugly little nothing, I still enjoyed the way I saw the world or saw a situation in, rather than the way this person did or this person did. And I felt like that was important. The scariest thing, I think, at the same time, and what I think people also have to be very strong to accept about themselves is, I mean, I live a life now, especially where I mean, I get to talk to you guys. I get to make music with people that I had on my wall as a kid. I've played in this country. I've played this instrument here. I've done this. And it's just really a strange thing to have accomplished all these dreams that I had. And, you know, I still feel like there's many parts of my creative life that haven't even been explored yet. And I think your habits and your the way your mind is wired, perhaps, because of whatever trauma you may have had, I still sink into these patterns of incredible self-doubt and self-loathing. And I just feel like, oh my God, it is truly because you suck. And I feel like that'll never stop for a lot of us, or for a lot of people. It'll happen like that forever. But as long as you can do enough work to get to a point where you could recognize that you've been able to create a good life for yourself. Right. And that means, that doesn't mean you have to play music with this person or that kind of, I mean, everyone can do this, I think.
And you get to have a life worth living. You know, that's what you've created.
That's the most important thing. And it's not about the things that I still tell myself I'm a failure, because I've never made a record that sounds like, you know, you guys, or sounds like something that you would throw on. You know, this is the things you tell yourself. But I do live a life at this point that I'm proud of, you know, and I think, yeah, I think it's all still a shock to me every day that I just said that out loud to you two.
Been lovely talking to you.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Thank you. It's been really, really nice. We've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Lol Tolhurst and Butchie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Wild.
Digital marketing, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas Kay.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
And you can reach us on Instagram and Facebook at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter at Cura Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram or at doubleelvis on Twitter.
Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2022.